Today, as promised, I am fortunate to be sitting with three people that I work with, who I enjoy very much working with. And I thought you would see, what I would bring you is three different opinions, different opinions, three different ways of seeing what is real, what is not real, what is sanity, what is not sanity. The reason for the question is the following. When we did the fund drive, and I had offered people a discounted consultation fee, we had many people, hundreds of people called, took advantage of that. And most of the people who came in just asked one simple question. What shape is my mind in? I'd like to know. It's like if you were to get a physical trainer and you'd go to the trainer and you'd say to the trainer, how is my body? You know, if you go to your doctor for a checkup and the doctor says, I'd like to get a full physical. How am I doing? What do my blood tests say? So they would come to me and they would ask, how's my mind? How is it? There's a very good question because most people who seek out a therapist automatically know that your mind's not in great shape because you're having troubles. So by the time you get to the therapist, you don't ask the therapist, how's my mind? You go to the therapist and you say, help me fix my mind. But what happens from the therapist's end? What happens from the end of the person who you visit when you go to see them? What do they see? How do they see it? A little while back, we had Neil Schachter from Mount Sinai Hospital, who is a specialist in lung disease. He talked about, as a doctor, what happens when a patient walks in, and he talks about, I look at how they walk. I look at how they sit. I look at the breathing rhythm they have. I look at their lips. I look and see if they're dry, if they're licking their lips. He talked about all the things that you never know a doctor is looking at. I see their responses. He says, I want to see things, but he's mainly all the things that he would be as a doctor doing a diagnosis that we wouldn't even know he was doing. Does the person yawn? Does the person seem to have, good faculty with their vocabulary and memory and so on and so forth? So I'm going to ask my friends here today to tell me what they perceive, and I'm going to start off with that basic question, which is an awkward question, of what would we consider sane, and when do we consider a person not in their right mind? I even hate saying the word. I just mean, when are you broken? When's your brain broken? When do you know something's wrong? You wake up in the middle of the night. One of the things I hear about people who take Ambien, I'm sure you know about this. By the way, my guests are Dr. Kent Robert Shaw. Kent, back to us.
Nice to be here.
And Dr. Scott Baum, amazing man. Hi, Scott.
Thank you, Armand. Nice to be here with you.
Transitional bioenergetic. No, he's a bioenergetic.
A dyed-in-the-wool bioenergetic.
A dyed-in-the-wood. Wool.
In the wood is
in
about
the wood,
right. That's right.
And Cindy Borlotto, who has just recently joined us. Cindy, welcome back. You were with us on Tuesday, and the phones were off the hook with people who wanted to talk to you.
Thank you, Armand. A pleasure to be back.
Oop, I don't hear you.
Thank you.
Yeah, let me see what is there. Try again. 1, 2, 3, 4...
Thank you, Armand.
Yeah, I hear. I see, but I have a microphone problem. All right. We are going to we'll get right back to Cindy. Let's start it off. Scott, if you would, tell me what you perceive. What do you think? What is sane? What is not sane?
Well, let me say something before I say that. You say it's a difficult question. Actually, it seems to me it's a reasonable question to ask therapists to have at least some operational definition for what constitutes whatever it is that's good and right in people's functioning. So I think it's a challenge. I walked into this not knowing what you were going to throw at us. So
yeah, but
I'll take a crack at it.
That's part of the good. That's part of the good news.
I think that people are sane when they're in relationship to reality. Now, what does that mean? Reality is not an absolute, but it is a process. And the process has to do with people's capacity to assimilate information, to mix the information that comes from outside with the information that comes from inside, to do the scientific task of understanding their own biases, emotional, psychological, ideological, and to be resilient enough to soften those biases and be able to evaluate information at as many levels of complexity as possible. Finally, knowing that in the end, whatever we come up with, as gut-sure as it may feel to us, is still always subject to uncertainty.
What did he say? Well, how do you see that?
Well, I think that one of the things that Scott's talking about is that people get to sort of understand their emotional world and their behaviors and their perceptions and get a sense of who they are and how they see the world, and somehow, you know, it makes sense. It's predictable. It's somehow based in reality. And your question about people coming in saying if they're sane or not, I hear a lot of times where people come in with incredibly complicated, mixed up, ambivalent emotions about the world around them, and they say, they think to themselves that that's sane because things should be neat and orderly and everything should have its place, black or white, good or evil and all that. And it's often very reassuring, I think, for people to hear that their emotional world filled with complicated ambivalence of envy and greed and anger and lust and all these things they think they shouldn't feel is actually quite normal and it's okay. And they're quite sane for being complicated humans with complicated emotions.
Well, it's an interesting question. I think there's a hidden issue in what you're saying, Kent, and I wonder what you think about it, and I wonder what you think about it, Armand. In the last 50 years, psychotherapy has undergone a transition in the belief that, starting much more with a belief that when a person reverts or regresses to a very primitive emotional experience, that then they become more sane via that primitive emotional experience. To me, and I think to others, this turns out to be something of an insane idea. Infants do not have a refined emotional reality. Infants are sane because their environment is very small and the data they have to accommodate is very narrow. And in that realm, it's not too hard to be sane. But being sane requires an extremely sophisticated, refined emotional awareness. You have to be able to follow the nuance of things. So now we elect leaders, like our present nameless leader, who doesn't believe in introspection. How can you be sane if you're not introspective? How can you know what's going on?
Well, before we go that, because before we go there, we couldn't.
How can you oppose it if you're not introspective? Well, we're not talking about that.
Which would spark our audience no end.
No end.
Well,
yes.
Wait a minute. Cindy Briel, Cindy, there's Kent has a question there. Scott has a question there. He says, what are you, stupid? Says age regression, going back to childhood to try to cure a thing. And you do age regression. So what do you say?
I do indeed do age regression. And what I say about that is that when we're doing age regression, we talked about this the other day on the air, we're not just going back in time to be the child again, to capture whatever sanity of the child. That's not what we're doing. We're going back in time to find the source of emotions that are troubling so that we can release that, and we bring back with us the adult consciousness, mm-hmm. and the adult learnings and the adult resources to a time in the past when maybe the child didn't have it. Mm-hmm. You know, children have fewer resources just by virtue of the fact that they have less experience of the world. Mm-hmm. So we understand things differently as children. We experience things differently as children than we do as adults. So when we do age regression, we do it to find the cause of emotions that might be troubling us, to really let them go and leave them in their place where they belong in the past, and at the same time to bring an adult understanding back to that with us so that we can then change our minds, really, fundamentally. And I mean that fundamentally. We change our minds mm-hmm. about our history. And, you know, our history always remains what it is. Because it is. The past happened. It happened as it happened, and it is what it is. We just change our response to that. And so we can change the way we go forward into the rest of our lives with this new understanding.
So I want to thank you. Now that's leading us to a process. Here we are, you know. Yes, I agree with you, Scott. What we used to think is you go back and you reclaim your childhood. And people in the 70s used to think you just walk around with flowers and you, as much of a child as you could be, is as wonderful as you could be.
Mm-hmm.
We don't think that nowadays. But it comes this big question about changing your reaction to things. Now, this is probably the biggest thing that people come to see us about. I get too jealous. I get too angry. You know, how many people have come to me and say, I don't know what's wrong with me, but I get angry at my mother. All of a sudden, I'm getting angry at my mother. Or somebody else came to me the other day and said, I'm suddenly getting angry at my husband. And saying the anger is not justified. I know my reaction is an overreaction. Now, we have a number of things that we see here, you know. Here we have Kent, you're a psychiatrist. You see people with major overreactions that are sometimes, you believe, chemically based.
Absolutely. That some of these people perhaps have a genetic or combination of their environment and genetics so that they're predisposed to have more variation and more fluctuations in their emotions and moods, and so that they would have a stronger outburst of, let's say, something that could be in many interpersonal relationships, anger, quite destructive and toxic to people.
So sometimes you'd see it and you'd say, Kent, okay, well, this is something that we could fix, but instead of by going to the depth of it, let's try to fix the source of it, which is some kind of an imbalance in your chemical brain.
Yeah, certainly the psychiatrist, you know, has a model of the brain that involves all this complicated neurochemistry and genetics. But certainly talking about the mind, you know, and anger, and about how so many men and so many boys growing up, that we're sort of told that all our other emotions other than anger are not okay. They're bad. They're shamed in us in some way, that we can't feel anxious, we can't feel shame, we can't feel sad, that one of the only ways that men can react to a whole slew of different things in the world around them is with the emotion anger, and all the other ones are subtly told by mom and dad are incorrect. I don't know if we'll use the word insane, but not right. They're not the right ones. The correct ones for a man should be, you know, anger or close up. And we as therapists obviously want people to be more flexible and more nuanced and more sensitive to the very complicated other emotions other than anger.
Well, I mean, this is probably for another show. I really have a very different opinion on the chemical imbalance thing, since we have no baseline understanding, and human beings are in constant imbalance, or else we would never eat anything. So we're constantly in states of imbalance and whatever that means, and we fluctuate from morning till night, and it's really way too complicated. Let's talk about something really much more concrete in terms of what you were saying earlier.
Well, would you say, Scott, at some point if a person comes in, and they say, suddenly, I don't know what's happening to me, but every time I go somewhere, I throw something, I can't hold it in my hand anymore. And you look at this and you go through a psychological assessment of it. Wouldn't you sometimes send somebody who may be hallucinating for medication just to...
Medication is an application. It's a technique to intervene in a process. But it doesn't tell me anything about what's going on underneath. And in terms of what you were talking about earlier, I work best with my own concrete, as you know, with my own concrete examples. But for example, I've been trying to understand my own racism for a long time. I have a very deep, abiding racism in my body. I wasn't raised in Alabama. I was actually raised by parents who were ostensibly very progressive people. And in an environment in Greenwich Village in the 1950s where actually it was pretty open. not to mention that many of the people were still racist. So there's some of it that's osmotic. There's some of it from the culture. There's some of it probably from my own personal history. I have little intimations of some things that went on, but I have no sure conclusion about that. I've gone back. I don't disagree with Cindy's ideas about going back as a way of understanding things and as a way of liberating feeling and developing the capacity to feel more and more. I believe in that. So here I am now in the present. I can either pretend that I've somehow, you see, this is where we have probably some disagreement, released these feelings. I haven't released them. If anything, I don't want to release them, because they're toxic and destructive, but I can face them, and I can embody them, and I cannot pretend to myself that I'm beyond them or that they're biochemical or anything else. They're part of my being, and it's insane for me, and it's a real struggle. My children don't seem to have this particular problem, which astounds me. I don't understand what's going on in their bodies, that they don't seem to have this intrinsic racism, but I accept it. I believe it's true. So there you are. It's insane for me to pretend that's not happening.
Well, let's stick with that example for a minute, Scott, because I've always known you as a man who's challenged many of your attitudes towards women, your attitudes towards life in general. Mm-hmm. You know, and now, you know, here on this, I was talking about this yesterday, my own racist attitudes that I'm challenging, and you're mentioning it. Don't you think taking the new anti-racist medication might help you?
No.
One that just came out that they give you where they give to the Ku Klux Klan and they take off their sheets and embrace everybody?
Oh, you're talking about LSD.
That's the 50s.
Sure. Oh, that's fine. Yeah, no, that stuff terrifies me. Are you kidding me? I wouldn't go near that. That scares the pants off of me.
Okay, so now, here's a question that you, I'm sorry to interrupt, but here's a question that you bring. The person who owns their mind is not afraid to question their mind. The person who has an attitude that is so strongly opposing any introspection, like our good example that you gave before, that kind of person is the scariest person. So a good test for sanity is, are you willing to question your mind? If you have no question, a paranoid person, who's a person who believes they're being persecuted, they come into my office and they say, I am sure this is going on. They feel sane. They feel that they know reality. People listening to this program believe that all of the people in the field of psychiatry are plotting to get even with them. You know, some people believe that. In fact, they're listening for us to make references to them. In fact, I probably just did. And that is the mind that won't question itself. So I think step one is a good test of whether or not you own your mind is, can you stand aside from it and look at it? Can you say, you know, what am I like? What am I like? And what's wrong? And what is it in here? What is it that gets me angry every time my kids make too much noise? What is it that gets me to talk down to somebody who happens to be an innkeeper? You know, where is that part of me that is being so nice to somebody who is clearly in a less fortunate position than I am? Where do you see your racism come creeping up, Scott? Just curiously.
Oh, it's with me every second.
But where does it creep up that you notice it coming out of your mouth? Like,
well, I'm a very well-socialized person who hides most of his negativity except from those close to him, and none of the people really close to me fit that category. But in the street, in the elevator, in my own consciousness, constantly.
Constantly.
You know, it goes back to something Kent said
in
our
dance,
discussion,
you know,
beforehand. Yeah.
It's in your dance.
Yeah.
This man loves to dance.
Yeah, well, we won't go there right now. You know, you were talking about vulnerability, and it seems to me that what goes along with what you're saying is it's not enough for me to question it. You know, I can question my own mind in a very closed system and be very superior and say, oh, I'm in touch with myself.
I asked myself where
right,
that was.
I'm in touch with my feelings. The whole problem is you can't do it without other people. So if you're sane, you're accessible, you're permeable, and what other people think and feel has to matter. And, you know, we're really not good at that. even the people who oppose the so-and-so, you know, we're really not good at that.
And especially the ones who take, especially the ones in the mental health profession. You know, I mean, in the mental health profession, part of the reason for going into it is to close off anybody else's perception about yourself.
I think part of the sanity question has to do with people understanding that they don't have all the answers. They don't have all the answers about themselves. They don't have all the answers about their belief systems. If we have four therapists here today with four slightly different belief systems, to me, part of someone's insane view of the world is a kind of grandiosity that I'm all-knowing. I know everything. I know everything about myself. I know everything. I see it in the addiction field where AA is anti-therapy, is anti-psychiatry. As opposed to, you would think that as people learn more, they're more introspective. And personally, the more I know, I don't know. The more complicated things are, the more I don't know if somebody else's belief system is right or wrong, because I don't know if my belief system is right or wrong. I just know what I know, and I feel what I feel.
But you know what people will say on the other end of my political spectrum to this, which we've all heard, is, well, then you don't have any values. Then you're just this relativistic, everything is okay. That's bull. There's a difference between what I believe about how the world functions or how things get to be the way they are and what I know is right and wrong. So I had this experience. I was thinking about this before I came, not knowing what you were going to ask us about. I had this experience a couple of years ago in my own therapy of suddenly realizing, I won't tell you the whole context, I don't remember the whole context, but that the devil has no interest in sexuality, right? All these people in the world saying the devil gets in there and wants you to have sex. I'm convinced the devil has no interest in sexuality. The devil is interested in that moment when one human being treats another like an object. That's what the devil is interested in. And unfortunately, because of how vulnerable sexuality is and how exposed we are in those moments, it happens a lot in that space. So you find the devil, whatever that is, an outside force or an internal reality or whatever, I don't know, but you find that entity floating around in that space a lot.
And you find it floating around in that space because of the vulnerability, which
That's
brings
right.
us to the question of vulnerability. How vulnerable should a person be? You know, I mean, what is it like? What's the ideal look like at the end when you, if you get to be sane, does it mean that you know, I remember the photograph of the Germans marching into the, under the Arch de Triomphe, and there's this Frenchman. This Frenchman, you know the photo I'm talking
he's
about?
Yeah, weeping,
and he's,
literally.
And there are tears in his eyes, and it's this very famous photo, and he's not crying, he's weeping. And there, ready to feel, yet feeling strong, I looked at it and I said, well, I guess that's what a man is. Somebody willing to feel. Yet there are men who feel too much. There are guys who are crying all the time, and they always, you know, they feel vulnerable all the time. So where's the line in here? Let me ask you, Cindy, what's your perception of this people's integration of their emotions into a solid self?
Well, in terms of vulnerability, I think, you know, we're all vulnerable at times, whether we want to be vulnerable or not, or whether we want to accept that we're vulnerable or not. So this is part of the human condition, right? This is part of what we experience. So I think in terms of vulnerability, how much is the right amount? Well, how much is the right amount? You know, just the right amount is what we want. What does that mean? Yes, and how do we know when we're too vulnerable? Well, when we can't really function, when we're disintegrating, when we're not safe. You know, there's part of being quote-unquote sane is feeling safe and feeling like you're okay and you know how to be okay. And sometimes, you know...
Now that's a big statement. Let's slow that down.
Ahead.
I think that's beautiful. Part of being safe is feeling safe. Part of being sane is feeling safe in the world. Feeling safe and knowing that you have the potential to react if necessary, but you don't feel on the edge of an overreaction every minute. You know, it's not like you're ready to fight if something happens. It's like you're you're calm inside yourself. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly what I'm talking about. I'm talking about most of the time there's this centeredness, there's this peacefulness. At the same time, of course, we have our this is the beauty of fear, right? Fear is to keep us from being destroyed when there is real danger. That's what fear is for, right? So we want to be able to have these emotions ready because they serve us, but we don't want to be living in them all the time because that we're not going to be able to function. And this is, you know, this is part of what stress is fear. You know, fear, stress is complicated, but part of what it is fear. And we have this, we're kind of in this state of physiological arousal all the time. We're on the edge all the time. And this really does interfere with our functioning. This really starts having us be disintegrate and not being able to function and be effective in our own lives, do what we feel like and what we decide we want to do in our lives. So the ideal is to be centered and calm in ourselves most of the time.
But then there are those people who get calm, they meditate, they calm down all feelings, they calm down everything. There are people who take medication and just calm themselves out. There are people who, you know, drop a pill, take a Valium, take a Xanax, and they're calm. So the ideal can't be calm.
Yeah, I think that you don't want to get numb. And so when we're talking about sane and a strong personality, I think it would be somebody who often doesn't get overwhelmed with anxieties and fears and anger. But when appropriate, when the outside world is acting in a way that one needs to have an appropriate level of anger to set boundaries with somebody who's going to harm me or somebody disrespecting me, I can connect with that anger. Again, I think that obviously being angry all the time is not okay. But I think a lot of patients that I see who are slightly depressed will come in and say, you know, I'm very spiritually developed. I don't get angry. But the truth is they're not aware of their own anger, or their anger frightens them, or conflict frightens them, so that they're really sort of justifying their passivity and the fact they let people walk all over them and not really getting in touch with you're angry a lot of the time and you're fearful of it. It frightens you for some reason that we should try to figure out. And that would make you a strong person who's often calm and anxiety free, but when appropriate has fear and anger at your disposal to deal effectively with the outside world. And are you okay with your inner world that has those emotions?
See, I think these two statements are about as good as it gets with respect to answering your question. However, and this you asked about what it's like as a therapist, so okay, we'll talk about the other side of this. And this works fine in terms of the structure of therapy, and I think what they both said now I completely agree with and was very well said. I just don't know how it works when you have to face your own mortality. See, at that point, as a therapist, my task becomes...
You're pulling out the trump card.
Well, it is the trump card, and Becker would have said, we're all insane just because of that, because we are a species ahead of ourselves evolutionarily. We know our own demise is coming, and we don't have any clue to deal with it, and while I had a patient once many years ago whose sole mission in life was not to be taken out by death. He couldn't stand the feeling of being rendered impotent, not being able to. He was a very strong man, very grounded, lots of practices of all kinds. What he wanted was not to have that moment when everyone would see him go, oh, my God, right? He couldn't stand that. He had all kinds of reasons for that, but he couldn't stand it. So in that sense, being sane is an ability to hand over to other people the capacity to hold the space for a while.
Well, we have to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to need to go into that. You know, do not go darkly into that. Do not go quietly into that night. Dark night.
Yeah.
Rage against the storm.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, my friends. This is Armand DeMille with Kent Robert Shaw, Scott Baum, Cindy Violetta. I did it again. And we will be back with you in a couple of minutes. No, this is Armando Miller. That was Zorba's Dance, by the way, because we need Zorba here because, I don't know, I always admired Zorba. I always thought there was something right about that kind of feeling. Although, you know, if you look at Zorba, too, and you examine his mind, he'd say, "Ah, well, look at my mind. Look at the fish," you know? So, you know, there are certain people who just say, "I don't question anything." And that doesn't necessarily mean that they're in great shape. We want to question our mind. We want to challenge what we're afraid of. I mean, if you're afraid of intimacy, whatever that means, I think it's an overused word, intimacy. But if you're afraid to get close to another person and trust another person and let another person look at you and see you for the way you are, if you're afraid to have the lights on or to walk out without makeup, you know, then you're afraid. Then there's something saying you, something about your mind that's, you know, giving you the wrong idea. You should be able to be yourself. To be yourself is a wonderful thing. And what Cindy Brialetta says is you've got to be able to not only be yourself, but to be calm in this kind of calm presence. That there's a presence about you that's not a repression of emotion, pushing down emotions. That's not what leads to calmness. But a calmness that comes from being okay, feeling safe in this world. I could handle what happens. You want to know how to handle a subprime mortgage market? You look at it, you deal with it, and you say, but that's only the subprime market. What about my heart? What about my soul? What about the way I am? What about my being? How can I, if I were to stand up broke with not a penny in my pocket, how would I do? Do you ever think about it just curiously, all of you here? If you had not a penny to your name and no profession, right, and psychotherapy suddenly ended and there was no profession and you couldn't write a book because nobody would buy it, and there you were penniless, how would you be?
I think about it all the time. Are you kidding me? That's the future I see coming. I think it would break me down completely.
And you think you'd collapse?
Absolutely.
So what are you going to do about that?
Well, I do what I do all the time. I work on building a person inside me. But, you know, your version of what I would call radical self-acceptance is that it works out in the end. I have no assurance that it works out in the end. I just believe it's more meaningful to me to be in contact with reality, whatever the reality is. And the truth of the reality of the subprime market is that some of those people got ripped off. So now what are they going to do? If they're sane, they're really angry. Now what? You can't make that anger go away artifact.
Absolutely. And I'm not saying that you would.
Okay.
But I am saying that not it will work out. It's not that it will work out.
No, you'll have to
but
do something.
But I will work out.
That's right.
I'm going to survive. I'm going to be... And maybe I won't survive.
Maybe I won't survive.
Maybe I'll die.
Maybe I
big
will.
Big deal. And what about maybe
That's
I'll die?
Big deal.
No, but let's talk about maybe I'll die.
Yeah.
Why is maybe I'll die such a bad idea?
I think the part before maybe I'll die scares a lot of people more than the fact that I'm going to die, which is scary enough,
mm-hmm.
but that I'm going to be dependent. We're talking about financially losing everything, and people's fears are often either from my, you know, financial or medical. And what underlies that fear, I think, is the fear of dependency, that I'm going to be needing someone's help. I'm going to need help from other people. And so I break down, again, perhaps a grandiose sense that I can take care of myself. I'm an island unto myself. I don't need anybody. I think a lot of fears about getting sick and financial problems has to do, I'm going to rely on my community, my family, people around me, and will there be anybody there who cares about me or loves me enough to help me out when I'm in need?
So you think that a lot of the fear of death is really the fear of dying, not the fear of the exit? Because, you know, certainly we have been around at our age, we've been around enough people that we have seen completely helpless who could barely function, and I think not the devil, but the other guy, whoever it is, did an interesting design to give us Alzheimer's so that, you know, you get a mind, you no longer have your mind when it comes to the end, so you don't even know it's happening when it's happening. So I think, but, you know, do you think that this is what the fear is, or is it the death itself?
I think death itself has its own, you know, bad feeling as well. I mean, Scott brought up Becker's book before about, you know, the underlying fear of death in a lot of people. And he, I think he went on to, you know, talk about how Freud, you know, talking about sexuality is, you know, just talking about, again, from my perspective of the book, our animal self, you know, that sexuality, aggression, all these things are things that we want to be, feel ashamed of, because we don't really want to think that when I'm 7 years old that I'm like that kitten or my dog that died or got hit by a car. I want to see myself more as an angel. I want to be, or, you know, unconsciously, if I'm perfect all the time, if I get 1600, if I make millions of dollars, if I'm perfect, my grandiosity is that I'm not just like the animals around me that I see dying, and I don't have their animal impulses like sexuality. I'm different. I'm better. I'm slightly elevated towards an angel, not an ape.
You know, the implications of what Kent is saying, I don't know if the people sitting outside listening get the same implication from this that I do and some other therapists do, but the implication is if we are really all equal on the level that he's talking about, and egalitarianism means not just regulating who gets the power, but actually means acknowledging that all of us really are on that level the same, then all this stuff about, well, we can't take the time to talk about it, we have to get things done, and, you know, you shouldn't waste so much time, is really all insane. The sane thing is to slow everything down and listen carefully and process things and arrive at some consensus where everyone can participate in the process. So, you know, that's really revolutionary. And that, for me, that maybe he wouldn't carry it that far. I don't want to speak for him, but that's where it goes for me.
Have you ever, Scott, taken yourself to your own death? Have you ever taken yourself to that doorway in any way?
No, my problem is different. My problem is that I was already there. I was there in that moment that Sue Grant talks about. She's written a book called The Reproduction of Evil. Certain people have been traumatized in a certain way, and I'm pretty sure this is true of me, although I can't recover all the experience yet to know, have had the experience of being with someone who would murder them. Maybe didn't get that far, but would have, and they're the only person there with that person. And that bends your sanity beyond repair in certain ways. And that's an experience I know about. So I don't know at this point. I mean, Kent could really be right about this, and I just don't know. I know people in my life whose relationship to death is very different from mine. And my terror may be, in some ways, an artifact of the experience I've already had, but I don't know if I can do much about that. I really don't.
Well, you know, and now you bring up an interesting point. See, you're saying that because of the experience of living with someone and being dependent on someone who really didn't have your best interest at heart, who wasn't just punishing you, but in a way wanted to annihilate you if they could, you died.
Yes. I was faced with
that
moment.
And that's the only way to get through it is to be dead.
Well, in the sense of mind, the only thing that was left to me was my mind. I retreated. I can almost feel the experience of retreating to a very small part of my cortex and just trying to get through the experience enough to have something left of me. And that's a tangible experience for me. That's not an intellectual idea. I had to come to it by going through it again and again and again. So my feelings about death are so conditioned by that I don't know at this point how one proceeds to develop wisdom and a connection to love and benevolence and feel that death is, as it is for some people I know, a transitional stage. But I believe that that's possible.
Well, let's say that we don't use the same word for both experiences, because it may not be.
Good point.
But if you get to the point where you've shut off, as many people listening have, where you don't feel anymore, which is the only way to get through many things, especially in early childhood, you just shut it off. You don't feel anything anymore. I don't feel, period. Then you're retrieving yourself from the grave. A little at a time, a little at a time, and a little at a time. And this started off, our question started off, what is sanity? And I think almost what you're saying, Scott, leads me to believe that sanity is the attempt at retrieving the self.
or being
and
the
constant
self.
Desire to retrieve the self, to become the self.
Yeah.
And if you've got to pull it out of a closet, you know, you've got to pull it out of a closet. If that kid is still hiding down there underneath the rafters, that makes a lot of sense. Being able to retrieve somebody, and I mean, that's part of the work I love doing with myself and with people I work with. Mm-hmm. It's helping them come out from underneath the rafters, you know?
Right. And, you know, this this feeling of no feeling, this is the point where we've given up. And this is, it's kind of, we've given up because we've been overwhelmed by the feelings. And they've been too much, and we haven't had helpful ways of dealing with them. And so we've tried our, you know, usually we try the things we know. And if they don't work, we keep trying them, even though they don't work, because that's what we know, right? So we keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. And at some point, we get frustrated. And then we keep trying and trying and trying. And then at some point, we just give up and we get depressed because it's too much already. We can't handle it. So the trick is really to allow ourselves to go to the place where we can feel again. And again, creating for ourselves a situation where it's safe to feel again. And maybe we need help with that, you know, one way or another. Maybe we need someone to guide us to that place where it's safe to feel again, where it's okay, where we have effective strategies to deal with our emotions. Because we're never not going to have emotions. We wouldn't want to not have emotions. That wouldn't be living. So we want to have our emotions. We just want to know how to process them in real time now. How do we work with these emotions? What do we do with them when we have them? That's what we want to get to, this place where we can really deal with our emotions, whatever they are.
Yeah, the book I'm thinking about called Soul Murder, you know, mm-hmm. talks about the consequence of abuse, and I think specifically childhood sexual abuse, as something, you know, that gets murdered. This sense of self that is capable to feel compassion and empathy and to connect and to feel and trust and all that somehow gets severely damaged. And obviously that's when, you know, people's capacity to feel alive and feel love and connected is impaired. And they often need therapists to help them to sort of uncover what went wrong and try to, you know, send them back on a different path, you know. But we get a lot of people who've been soul murdered.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it brings me to the question of the old 70s concept, Scott, was they called it integration of the mind, body, spirit, and emotions. You know, I mean, now let's think about that. Are we really... I know you're a body therapist. You're a body-oriented therapist. You make sure in the work that you do, body, mind mm-hmm. are definitely integrated.
Right.
Do we consider soul? Do we consider that anymore? Do we consider...
Yeah, sure. The person's unique identity, I don't need to make it a religious, ideological thing. A person's unique identity, a person's themness is irreducible. It doesn't belong to anyone else. No one else is entitled to govern it. That was the beauty of what came out of the 70s. The problem was that people like Reich, for example, were Rousseauian, and they believed that this thing resides inside a person and only needs to be liberated. And that once you liberate it, there it is. Well, it turns out, as Kent is saying, first of all, it can be even destroyed, perhaps, certainly severely harmed and deformed. But more realistically, it's deformed in all of us. There is no absolute core to fall back on. We're all constantly scientists. We're evaluating data. We're making the best judgments we can. And we're fools if we think that we can arrive at absolute conclusions. That isn't to say we can't make value judgments. We can't say some things are wrong, mistreatment of people, murder, exploitation. That's a separate set of issues. We all do the best we can to arrive at some consensus. But after that very small collection of human functions, all the rest is process. It's all process.
This is Armand DeMille with Kent Robichaud, Scott Baum, Cindy Braioletti. You know what I mean? You know what it's like to just sit around and be able to talk to guys and say, so what do you think of? What do you think of? You know, how does it work? How do you get it together? Must you be an activist? I got to ask the big question because we have about 7 minutes. And the big question is not the trite question, but I'm going to ask about love and the and how love relates to this. And I don't mean love in the love shmov kind of way. I mean a relationship between two people. Is it kind of essential? How is it useful? Do we need it? Do we not need it? Can you make it on your own? What do you think? Let me give us each 2 minutes, okay? Of course, Cindy, start with you. What do you think?
I think yes, yes, and yes to what you said. I think love is essential. I think we are social creatures, and we do feel the need for connection inside ourselves. And certainly in the place we came from, our connection to each other was literally essential to our survival, our physical survival. I think we all got here because we were able to connect with others of our kind and work together and help each other. And so I think that love is essential, and I think that it's a really important part of our lives.
When you say love is essential, do you mean being in a love relationship is essential?
No, I don't mean that. I was just about to continue. I was going to say, at the same time, I think we can be on our own. We can love ourselves, let's say that. Because this is loaded too, right? This is really hard. How do we love ourselves? Mm-hmm. But we can do that. We can give ourselves the love that we need. At the same time, I think that we seek human connection. And I think we get lonely, and I think we don't feel very good if we're alone all the time. I think there's some balance, even when you're in a love relationship with someone, I think there's some balance between the time when you want to be together and the time when you want to be separate from each other.
You know, I was just interviewed by New York Times. I think it's going to be an article next Thursday. Well, they ask, why do people steal when they're working at home? Why do they steal from the companies they work from? Why do they take Post-its and pencils and pens? And I said, because they're lonely. Because the idea now is you're working at home alone. You have your own computer. You're no longer in that family of a corporation that you used to have. And you get faced with being alone, which becomes that interesting place. Because if you don't love yourself, being alone is a really tough place. There, you can only either go dead,
right?
You know?
That's a dark and scary place.
Or get angry.
Right.
Right? So what do you think, Scott? Relationships, do you think they have any meaning in this search for...
Well, I think... I have to say, I'll give a plug here. My wife really wrote a brilliant paper about this that has to do with how you raise a sexually healthy child, which has some of the issues Cindy's been talking about the need for safety and respect of the person's unique identity. Love is an energetic process. I don't really understand it. It's some sort of basic connection with the benevolence in the universe. And when people are soul murdered, they cease to have that connection. It makes having guidance in life very difficult because love is a guiding force. But it's also an extremely complex, very refined experience. It's not, as you say, you know, sort of mushy-gushy. It's this ever-changing, very, it's like any other organic process. It's very complex, and it is the basis which guides people. And so, talking about sanity and insanity, here we are in a world full of people, like Kent said, run by men. Let's not play around. The world's run by men. Come on. And we study, interestingly enough, we've studied mostly mothers, if we've studied anybody. We haven't hardly at all studied fathers. You know, we talked about this, you and I. And here are people whose capacity to love has been so constricted, namely men, myself included, so that it really does function at a very primitive level. And it's not part of our social policy to insist that people who are going to make decisions for the rest of us or for the collective have to be able to be capable of love at a very refined level. They have to be in relationship with everybody, with all of us.
It'd be a nice test. I can imagine designing the questionnaire. Kent, what do you think? We got a couple of minutes.
I think, again, the love, the self-love that we talked about, or Cindy talked about, would be, to my thinking, certainly self-acceptance, you know, self-acceptance. Because I think love implies, you know, I guess at least for a lot of patients, you know, love like grand, you know, I'm great, I'm wonderful, you know. So I think people get to a thought that if I achieve some certain level of success or greatness or beauty, the show that Armand and I talked about a few weeks ago, that then I will be loved by people. But we're really talking about admired in terms of a competitive, successful place, as opposed to an internal sense of self-acceptance with all my flaws, with all my shortcomings, with all the humility associated with that, and the ability to then value, I think, love and connecting with others as more important than my wish to be loved and my wish to be admired by others. So I think that capacity to love each other and to feel love and altruism and concern and empathy for others equal to our own feelings is the power of love. That's so important for people to connect and to interconnect with each others. And for me personally, that becomes the most important thing, the love relationships, not whether I'm the most popular person on today's radio show and David Letterman's going to ask me. That's about me. That's about self. Love is about others and wishing to make others feel good.
You know, and it's beautiful to see what happens in this very room between four people. And you could just see the working of it. It's a beautiful thing. Hey, my guests, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, Dr. Scott Baum, Cindy Brialetta. What a wonderful thing. If you want a copy of today's program, you could go to thepositivemind.com or you could go to WBAI.org, either one. Or you could send an email to any of us, any of the people here, send it through me, Armand@thepositivemind.com, and I will forward that along. I will be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m. Thank you, my friends. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome. As always, it's a pleasure to be here with you.
Absolutely a pleasure. Thank you.
Talk about creating a safe space.